OTB AM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show. Get the full show straight to your phone by subscribing to the OTB AM podcast wherever you get yours. The OTB Podcast Network.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Now then, you're very welcome back. So we're looking through the Sunday Papers. I'll give you the headlines first of all, starting with the Sunday World. It's about Dublin, really, and their dominance last night. Dubs steamroll past Royals on night of emotional tribute at Croke Park. Dublin 321, Meade 9 points. Picture of Stephen Cluxton with a read there pre-game. And Farrell, I'm not worried. That's Andy Farrell. And beneath that, Harry Kane were well able. Victory over Man City has happy Harry dreaming of a Premier League title. Sun Sport then. They go with Mourinho on the back page. Dr. Feelgood is the headline. Mourinho hails a clinical display. And then alongside that, you will see a picture of Alan Kelly, former Republic of Ireland goalkeeper, now the goalkeeping coach. Mole in the story isn't me, Alan Kelly. Neil O'Riordan writing here, hitting out at innuendo, suggesting he is the mole in the Irish dressing room. And then there's a picture as well of James Ryan and Jacob Stockdale, a penny for their thoughts. England 18, Ireland 7 yesterday at Twickenham. The Mirror then, again, it's a picture of Stephen Cluxton placing a wreath in front of the hill. Dublin 3-21, Meath 9 points. And beneath that, Alan Kelly, their lead story, Machine Gun Kelly. Ex-Ireland keeper spits bullets as he slams chat that he was behind the leak of changing room video. Next, we have the Sunday Times. A picture of Peter O'Mahony looking to the sky forlornly. You suspect he's looking up at the scoreboard quite possibly, or the replay of something on the big screen at Twickenham. Looking for inspiration is the headline. Fourth straight loss to England leaves Ireland stuck in a rut. And again, beneath that, it's Alan Kelly, who took to Twitter yesterday. Alan Kelly disgusted by leak smears. Now, the Mail on Sunday then. It's a picture of Billy Vunipola dragging James Ryan to the ground yesterday. The headline is dominated. Ireland's attempt to beat ruthless England at their own game runs into a brick wall. England 18, Ireland 7. And then beneath that again, Philip Quinn here with Alan Kelly. Kelly blasts innuendo over his Bulgaria absence. So that's the Mail on Sunday. And then Sunday Independent, going with again a picture of Stephen Cluxton. Resistance is futile, Joe Brolly writing here. Another romp, Dubs in danger of rendering Gaelic football redundant. And Brendan Fanning on the right hand side, Ireland running to English brick wall, is his summation of events at Twickenham yesterday. Very happy to say we have Bernard Jackman with us, player with Leinster in Ireland, head coach of Grenoble and the Dragons. And Johnny Murta, five-time Irish flat champion jockey, winner of all the big races, and reviewing the papers with us for the first time. Johnny, great to have you with us.
Morning, how are you?
We're very well. Bernard, how you doing?
Good, thank you. Good.
So, Johnny, I'll start with the good stuff. I mean, you don't want to talk about Meath, and Bernard doesn't want to talk about the rugby, so tough luck. Here's Joe Brolly. Meath's chances of success before last night's Leinster football final were about the same as those of Donald Trump's legal team. And he talks for talks about Dublin in danger of rendering Gaelic football redundant. Grown men look down. They are reminded of their lack of worth. And he says this is their third annihilation of the underdog in consecutive weeks. David Hickey's prophecy of 10 in a row is beginning to look conservative. I thought of the Kildare lads sitting at home drinking a can and thinking, thank Christ. And at the end, he says, Pat Spillane said afterwards that words failed him, which was the night's only positive.
Yeah, well, you know, all us pundits, I was a pundit on ITV, you have to put a big spiel on it. The one you want to get them to bring you back next week or next week's column, so you have to kind of jazz it up a bit. Humiliation, I see he used there. Like, being 10 points up against Cavan and losing by a point is a little bit similar, really, but we believe, us Mead people going there, we were going to give it a real go. We thought we had a chance. The team was young. They had no fear. We needed to start well. Two goal chances in the first 10 minutes. And then they missed them chances. And then everything just, you know, it just goes from bad to worse after that. Dublin are a brilliant team. They've really bought into what it means to play for your county. The values they have, the night that was in it, and they played exceptionally well. You know, they blew Meath off the park. But if one of those two goals had to go in early, I'm not saying Dublin wouldn't have won, but it might have made it, you know, a longer, a tougher night for them. So, you know, humiliation. I think it's hard on young Mead people who played yesterday, trained for 6 or 8 months to read those words. But as I said, Joe has a good job in the Independent and he's on the TV. And as I said, as a pundit, you need to jazz it up a bit to make sure you're back for the next one.
You could argue, though, Bernard, 21-point defeat in a final, it's probably something the players themselves would be a bit humiliated over.
Look, they'll take a long time to get over it, and there's no backdoor this year. But we have to give credit to Dublin as well. They're absolutely ruthless. I suppose, you know, I was part of a Dragons team coming to the RDS to play Leinster, and we lost by, you know, 40 points. And, you know, we prepped well. The lads gave it everything they had, but just at that stage weren't able to be competitive with them. And that's, you know, that's the challenge for other teams now, to get their act together and bring through players. And obviously it's very difficult, the resources aren't necessarily there, but you know, on last night's performance, Dublin potentially could go 10 in a row. They just look to be getting better and better, and unfortunately, you know, it's there's so many one-sided games, a little bit like in my own sport in rugby, in the Pro 14. It's hard to judge teams when, you know, one team is just winning so easily.
Johnny, what do you think? I mean, on the one hand, it looks now like the Dubs have harnessed, you know, modern day science, and they have, you know, harnessed all the advantages that they naturally have, be it population or finances and all these kind of things. And so the future can look a bit bleak from the perspective of a Leinster Championship for the likes of Meath and the likes of Kildare and these other teams and Laois. On the other hand, you would think, you know, whatever about matching the size of the Dublin squad, you would think that some of the other counties could get together and get 15 to 16 to 17 really good players in the county, train like dogs, and on a one-off match be getting closer to Dublin at some stage. But we're just not seeing it at the moment.
Not at the moment, no. But that's like, that's how they react is nearly more important to me than last night's result. How are they going to react in Division 2? You know, can they all get together in the next couple of months and say, right, let's get back into Division 1. Let's build again. But you know, that's what they have to do. The Kildares, the Westmeads, the Lough, the Laois, the Meads. And somebody said last night that Meath have beaten Dublin at minor and under 21 in recent years, and so has Kildare. So it's just bringing them all together, creating what Dublin have created. They've created something that it means, it's so special, it means so much to play for your county again. That, like, 10 minutes to go, Dublin are 20 points ahead. The hassling and the harrowing they were giving the Meath players still at that point. You know, there was no let up. There was no foot off the gas. And that's where, like, the other teams have to realise how fit you have to be, how together you have to be. And it's like looking at Aidan O'Brien in our game. He's got all the best horses. He's, you know, he's the world's best trainer in horse racing. Do we all fall away, or do we, you know, pick our battles and try and get up there? He sets the bar. Dublin has set the bar now in the GAA, and in Leinster especially. Do we fall away and cry about all the resources he has, or do we up our game and look forward to the next season and say we're going to give it one hell of a run again? And that's all you can do. And if you go to bed at night and you answer yourself, did I do everything I could today? You can't ask for any more.
Okay. Let's check in with Valerie Mulcahy for a moment. She's at Porky Cueve, Tipperary Cork in the Munster football final. Valerie, what's the latest?
So after 13 minutes, it's Cork 3 points, Tipperary 4. Tipperary got off to a blistering start and scored 3 points in a row. Conor Sweeney with 2, and also followed by Michael Quinlivan. And then Cork got a bit into Luke Connolly with 2 points. Mark Collins popped over free after a very good penetrative run, which led the Tip defence to doing a high tackle on him to try and stop that attack. Ian McGuire turned over ball and what happened there? Yeah, Mark Collins got in, and then we've got another free from Luke Connolly, 45, and it's over the bar. So beautiful strike off the ball. So now it's back to level scores with 14 minutes gone here.
Okay, thanks, Valerie. Bright start there. We're here reviewing the papers with Johnny Murta and Bernard Jackman. Bernard, to the rugby then. England beating Ireland for the fourth time in a row at Twickenham yesterday. So, for instance, I mean, it's all over the papers, as you can imagine, 18 points to 7. Neil Francis talks of, you know, for 2018 to now, the Ireland side that turned up yesterday, a pale imitation of that 2018 side. England did what they had to do. And in essence, it was like a squad practice game where the junior side are given the present of a ball and asked to see if they could come up with some way of troubling England. He says, don't ever get confused by the scoreline. This was a guileless and clueless performance, as one-dimensional as I've seen in a long time. And despite an 11-point margin, Ireland were never even close to troubling England. Later on, he says, this was a travesty of a game. It felt like I'd gone to the dentist, had my gums, my entire face, and then my brain anaesthetised. My apologies. England defensively are just unstoppable. He says of Ireland, surely some of the senior players would have put their hand up and say, we need more. We need to show greater intelligence on how to break down a side like England. For instance, then, Clive Woodward, domination from start to finish. England controlled this contest virtually from start to finish. Not for a minute did I think they would lose. England had Ireland where they wanted them for most of the game. And he says, and maybe this is damning in a kind of passive enough way, he says, save for one moment of invention at the end for Jacob Stockdale's try, they contained the visitors with ease. And then, you know, he's very much talking from an English perspective here. He says, a better team on the day than Ireland would have unleashed that chip through or grubber more often. The way England set up defensively, they're very vulnerable to that kind of well-worked move, the sort France are currently pulling off at will. You know, in a way, it's kind of damning that Clive Woodward is almost saying, geez, we need to watch this because a side with a bit of creativity can take advantage of the way we're defending. The frustration as an Irish viewer is the way they're defending is not new. We knew exactly how they would defend because it's how they've defended for the last couple of years. And still we're kind of saying, oh, no invention and just playing into their hands almost.
Yeah, it was a very dominant display by England, and I don't disagree. I mean, Francis used an analogy of King Arthur and Cerdric, and you know, this Irish side was hardly worth killing. I don't agree with that. I think the players put in a huge level of commitment, honesty, but obviously, unfortunately, the standards we expect are more than that now. And I think, you know, when they review that today and tomorrow, they'll realise that they ran themselves out of petrol by how they played, and they fed into England's energy. And I don't know if you remember, there was a clip where Johnny May got a turnover and the camera went to Toje, and he celebrated that moment like it was a World Cup winning try. And that's the reality with England at the moment. They celebrate big defensive moments. They celebrate winning the scrum, you know, in their own 22, winning a high ball like they are, you know, a try from their own line like they got with Johnny May. And we unfortunately gave them too many opportunities to get those energy boosts through the game with our strategy and attack. And Peter Riley, you know, he quotes some stats from the RFU website. We had 69% possession, 72% territory. England made 233 tackles compared with Ireland 64, and five the England pack made it into the 20s for tackles made, which is probably some kind of record. But that's our fault as well, and that's us chasing something that isn't necessarily you know, a key factor in winning a game. And it'd be like, you know, from a racing analogy, you know, to have a horse that's in the lead for 4 furlongs, but it's a 6 furlong race. And that's possession and territory are not relevant at the moment in terms of winning international games. And Eddie Jones, he understands what wins international games. And unfortunately, it's kicking the ball more than the opposition. It's having a very strong defence and a very strong set piece. So while I admire where Ireland are trying to go and Mike Catt's trying to have an influence, and we are trying to evolve our attacking game. And let's be honest, the public wanted this, and this is a big criticism of Joe Schmidt. Unfortunately, they aren't necessarily what's going to get you wins quickly, particularly against teams who have more power and more talent. So that's the question mark now, is in, you know, are we going to have time to develop this all singing, all dancing attacking game, which New Zealand have? It's more part of their DNA. And at the moment, they're finding it hard to get wins against teams who have a very solid defence and a good kicking game, as we saw against Argentina and to a lesser extent against Australia. So that's just the worry for me, is that we're chasing something that sounds sexy but mightn't necessarily get us trophies.
Right, okay. So like things like the line out was a disaster, you know, and it's not the first time the line out has let Ireland down, and all those set piece issues are going to have to be looked after. Can you explain though, what is the logic or what is the game plan when, not for the first time, far from the first time, we're seeing an Irish team go backwards with all that possession. We're seeing an English wall, 13 bodies. They're not really contesting rooks all that often. Obviously, if a Curry or an Underhill sees their chance, they take it. But in the main, two tacklers, Irish player goes nowhere, back up, English line is set, ready to go again, rushes up. For instance, you know, we've often said, well, a little kick over the top might put manners on that English defence. It doesn't seem like those little wrinkles or bits of ingenuity are there. Eddie O'Sullivan made the point afterwards, you could, you know, if a defence had changed what it was doing on the hop, you could see how it might catch out an attack. But this just seems like we're watching the same game over and over again.
Yeah, and like the really good defence coaches don't change regularly. They just back their system. It's the attack that needs to change to adapt and try and find weaknesses. So I would agree. Look, the players will play what game plan is put in front of them. Maybe they felt that they could outmuscle England. Maybe they felt the more phases we built, the more holes that would open. But the reality was, the more phases we built, the tireder we looked and the more energetic they looked. And it was the same in France. We had loads of opportunities in France. We had loads of possession. But for the key moments, that killer instinct, they were way more clinical. And the set piece is a huge issue, Joe. And some of the thought process behind it is baffling to me. I mean, the laws have changed around them all. It's so much easier to defend them all now than it was 2 years ago. So 2018, we won some very tight games. And in some of those games, we kicked to the corner and we scored from a maul try, and it gave us a huge lift, and it gave us obviously 5 or 7 points. In the 2019 World Cup, there was over 200 kicks to the corner, 200 mauls. How many ended up in a score?
10,
in a
20.
Try? Three.
Out of 200,
yeah.
Okay.
Out of 200, okay. So, yes, you know, think back to the French game. You know, we kicked to the corner twice while I was very much in the game and ended up, you know, giving away a penalty and being shoved into touch both times. And again, England scored first, scores 5-0. Farrell misses a conversion. We're away from home. You know, we're talking about having a young team. We've got a good goal kicker. And instead of going 5-3, we go into the corner and we lose the line out. And obviously, Johnny May ends up scoring. Later, we got a scrum. We're under pressure in the scrum. We're always going to be under pressure in the scrum. The very first scrum of the game, we got a free kick. They go early. You know, I would say if you want to avoid England scrum, you don't go for another scrum. You could take a quick tap, you put up a Gary Owen, whatever. We went for another scrum and we barely won the ball. Kyle and Doris got picked up by the nine.
Yeah.
Later on in the game, we have a penalty under the post. We've gone to the corner 4 or 5 times. It's under the post, 5 or 6 yards out, where Chris Farrell gets held up. And we asked Conor Murray to kick it back into the corner again. And he nearly misses touch. But anyway, it didn't matter. From the line-out maul, they take the ball off us and they score. So it's like we're still playing, or it's like we're not studying the stats of our own strengths and weaknesses of how the game is going, and we're trying to do some of the things we did in 2018, but without the accuracy or the efficiency.
Johnny Murta, I don't know if you saw the game, the coverage today. Anything jumping out at you?
No, I did. I watched the game. Listen, we had Johnny Sexton, Tadhg Furlong, Dan Levy, Tadhg Byrne, Ringrose, Henshaw. They were all missing, like, and England looked very strong. That was a lot of the team that was in the World Cup. You know, I think Ireland are, I think they're better than the result. It did look, as you say, that we just try to take them on, you know, to bash through, which you're not going to do against England because they love that. And I was very interested looking at James Ryan's reaction. You know, Mario Tauge really dominated that game. And James Ryan, you could see, captain in Ireland, the frustration was coming out on him. He'd done a few silly things. But I do believe over the next couple of years before the World Cup, he will lead Ireland. You could see by his reaction, he did not like losing. And I like to see that in players, especially young players. You know, he's going to give Mario Tauge plenty of it over the next couple of years. And I believe when those other young players come through, like it was an autumn international. You know, you have to give young lads a chance, or lads that haven't been getting a chance to see how you play in the big pressure games. You know, Twickenham, England, big pressure. I thought a lot of them did well. And as I said, a few mistakes for the tries. couple of tackles missed on Johnny May for the second try. The first try, the young lad caught in under the ball, you know. So England were, as you say, very comfortable defending. Didn't create all that much going forward. And I think when we get the likes of Joey Carberry, Harry Byrne, Ryan Baird, James Lowe's on his second game for Ireland, I believe when we get those guys moving, you know, I believe we'll be as good, if not better, than England in a couple of years. If we maintain progress. People are saying we're not progressing at the moment, but when you get all those great, like Johnny Sexton not being there yesterday, like, sure, he runs the show for Ireland. You know, it's a big ask for a young guy to come in who's playing second to him in Leinster and run the show against England. So, you know, the result was bad, it looked bad, but I'm still a believer that we have enough good players that in, what, three and a half years' time, we will get to a semi-final of a World Cup with all those players in fit. And as you think, I don't know about the systems in rugby, but surely we should have a system in that suits us, because it's like any sport, you have to play to your strengths.
I love the optimism. I can't say I'm sharing it. I can't say I share it.
What place are Ireland now to get to the semi-final of the World Cup in 3.5 years' time?
Well, I'd say you'd get a good prize at the moment, put it that way.
Well, I'm going to have 100 quid on, and in 4 years' time, when you bring me back on here, you can get Paddy Power on the phone there, and we'll get the odds there now.
Look, just to come in on that, I love your optimism as well, Johnny. And in fairness, I wouldn't question any of the effort. In actual fact, to make England make that many tackles shows a huge amount of work rate. And likes of Peter Manny and Ronan Kelleher sprinting back when Johnny May made that line break, you know, showed the intent. You know, definitely James Ryan. I think Brendan Fanning has a good little quote on it. So, you know, James Ryan was respected around the rugby world. Not the same thing as a Toje who would be feared. And I think we just need to say, at the moment, Atoje is absolutely at the top of his game. And there's lots of England players in there who are Johnny May, Owen Farrell. I think Underhill and Curry are going to be outstanding. We know the Vunipola. So England are the litmus test, Six Nations champions, you know, World Cup finalists, and probably only for an injury to their tight head, maybe would have won the World Cup. So there's no shame in it. I just think we need to look at strategically what we're doing, because we have good players and we have the makings of a very good side. And to get to the level where we can beat England and France and New Zealand again, it'll just take a little bit of time and a little bit more understanding of what we're good at.
But listening to you there, it sounds like we're on the track of the wrong game plan for the current climate.
Look, I can understand. So Mike Catt, it's very hard for Mike Catt because he's working with a set piece that's not functioning. You could say it's difficult for the forwards coach because Tyke Furlong is out and he's a cornerstone of your pack. But I just think it's, maybe we're going to beat this team that plays massive amount of possession rugby like Joe Schmidt did in 2018. Maybe we're going to find a way of doing that better. So, you know, we're not as we're not struggling like we have it since 2018. And in fairness, that's fine. If we've spotted something that's the game is changing, and it's going to come back full circle to possession and territory, well, then we're ahead of the curve. But unfortunately, at the moment, we're playing a game that's behind the curve, if you get me.
Yeah. I don't suspect you're seeing that curve coming back to Ireland's way anytime soon, based on what you're saying.
Well, I haven't seen anything that's going to change in the laws. Like, the laws have changed to make it more of a hindrance to have the ball than not have it. So that's the only thing we're going against. Based on what we saw yesterday, we're going against the rest, and that's sometimes you're better off going against the rest, but just I don't see how we have the power, the dynamism to an offloading game to make that type of play work at the moment. But maybe it'll come with time in camp, etc. So like, we have good players, and we just need them to get comfortable with the game plan.
Yeah. When Clive Woodward talks about, you know, a team with a bit more invention could have potentially hurt the English defence, like, that is very, very damning. And for instance, the kicking game, if we're talking about that, and little dinks over the top to at least try and put manners on the English defence rushing up. We seem to do the same thing over and over again for far too much of that game. And then you see the one or two little kicks and they, like, Stockdale scores a try off one, there's almost another try off the other. They're the only two times I really remember it happening, and you're kind of thinking, Why did we only do the thing that brought us a bit of success twice?
Yeah, well, look at it. I did a piece, analysis of the last three games against England previous to yesterday.
Sorry to interrupt. I saw that, by the way. I mean, your broody look down camera, honestly.
I got stitched up there. I
didn't, oh, my God. I didn't know what I was doing. Honestly, there were women fainting across Ireland with that slow-mo and the blink, just the slow-motion blink. Bernard, it was one of the sexiest things I've ever seen.
Oh, man, yeah. Hollywood signed me up. No, I got absolutely stitched up. But in actual fact, my point was that England have destroyed us in terms of finding kick space, winning the high ball contest, etc. In fairness, we actually didn't let them find the space as much yesterday. Obviously, we were a little bit unlucky for Hugo Keenan try.
Yeah.
The Johnny Mate trip over the top, that's a different scenario. The problem was, when we tried to kick it back to them, our kick accuracy was really poor. Okay. And that was a skill set issue. So I could see a development in terms of learning. I just, obviously, a skill set issue let us down.
Okay. Listen, we have to take a short break for news headlines. Johnny Murtagh will be back on World Cup 2023 to rub all our faces in it. We'll make that commitment now. We're taking a short break for news. There's loads more in the papers. Lots of Stephen Kenny talk, as you might imagine. We'll get to that in 1 second. And we'll be back to Valerie Mulcahy at Porky Queef. We have Johnny Murtagh and Bernard Jackman looking at the Sunday papers for us. So, Johnny, the Stephen Kenny coverage is everywhere. I mean, after 8 games, no wins, 1 goal, he needs this like a hole in the head at the moment.
He does, yeah. It's looking bleak, all right. You know, the one thing I miss about riding is the jockey's room, because in the jockey's room, it's sacred. What goes on in there stays in there. The crack, the stories. You're out with the public. You know, you're in there with your friends, and you know what goes on in there stays in there. But obviously, you know, something's been leaked out. I haven't seen the video, so it's tough to comment on it. Mm. But he's got a tough job, you know. He's following Mick McCarthy, whose football was not good enough. His style wasn't good enough. He's following Martin O'Neill, who I know well. He's a smart guy. He played to his strengths. You know, it was boring football, but he obviously looked at the players he had, and to be competitive, this is what we have to do. So we brought in Stephen Kenny now, and after eight games, he has 4 draws and 2 losses. And again, being fair to the man, he hasn't had a real clean run at it with the COVID and players being out. I'd love to know his best 11 or his best 15 or 16 players to see how they would get on in a group like with similar teams. But he hasn't had a real fair chance yet in my book. But I think the Irish people are expecting them to play like Barcelona here now. You know, everybody wants to play like Pep Guardiola, come out, play from the back and, you know, pass it through the lines, pass through the middle and, you know, get it up to the centre forward who's going to score 2 or 3 a game. So, you know, what do we want? Like, do we want this free-flowing football, which is always dangerous, or do we want a result? Like, that's what we have to ask ourselves as fans, as viewers, as spectators of Ireland. We'd love to see free-flowing football and winning, beating England or beating Bulgaria 3-0 or 3-2 or something like that, but you know, that is not going to happen with the players we have at the moment if we don't give them some little chance. And I suppose, as I said, you know, Stephen Kenny needed this like a hole in the head, really, going in now answering questions about a video he put up trying to motivate players. And I'm a bit of a Roy Keane fan. If you have to start putting videos up to motivate guys to play for Ireland, I think the players themselves have to look at themselves. You know, like, you should be absolutely bursting to put on the green jersey, represent Ireland, no matter who you're playing. Friendly, World Cup qualifier, European qualifier. You know, you shouldn't need a video. And if you do show a video, it should be, it's in there. It's our little bit of secrecy or whatever it is in there shouldn't come out. But He's going to have a tough time over the next couple of months, I think. And it's like, you have to ask who leaked the video and why. Mm.
So looking at the coverage, and there's lots of it, you know, for instance, it's even on page two of the main section of the Sunday Times, let alone the sports section, and it's Mark Tighe and Paul Rowan here. They're saying Kenny to miss penalties over anti-English pep talk, miss penalties as in there's going to be no great fallout from it. I mean, it makes you wonder why the FAI had to talk about, you know, an urgent report and getting to the bottom of it and all becoming so public. So what Mark Tighe and Paul Rowan say here is that review into Kenny's use of the motivational video that included references to the 1916 Rising was launched last week. The video apparently is, quote, relatively tame, according to sources, but Kenny's pre-match speech after the video is more of the issue. They say here, the manager is said to have referred to the No Irish posters that used to be displayed in England in an attempt to motivate the players. One source here in the Sunday Times says, this has to be seen in a COVID context. Not sure what that has to do with anything. Stephen said he was not anti-English, but that the English had always disrespected the Irish. He said they viewed Ireland as a team of championship players, and the only way to get them to respect us was to perform. So they go on to say here, Paul Rowan and Mark Tighe in the Sunday Times, that the FAI was told a number of people who attended the team talk were, quote, unhappy with its content. And that was even before the Daily Mail story last week. Alan Kelly, and at the start, Alan Kelly's in a lot of the back pages, very angry that he's been talked about as somebody who talked to the media and refuting that completely. But they say here in this piece in the Sunday Times, Alan Kelly, the goalkeeping coach, is among those who have said they did not think the team talk was appropriate, but he is not suspected of leaking the story. So he is not suspected of leaking the story. And he took to Twitter yesterday saying enough is enough, absolutely furious and disgusted with the narrative. He's never bleated to the media in 35 years, he said, despite playing in some very interesting dressing rooms. Then they finish up this piece in the Sunday Times by saying there is widespread concern within Irish football circles that the story was leaked by someone seeking to damage Kenny, who is still seeking his first win as Ireland boss in eight games, etc. Bernard, what do you make of all this? There's a couple of different angles, obviously. There's the wisdom of, you know, going down the historical aspect of Ireland-England games to motivate the group. Then there's the FAI reaction. There's the leaking, quote-unquote. Where are you on all this as a player and a coach who's had to, you know, dabble in all this stuff, I suspect?
Yeah, I remember back my early days in my career, we had a match up in Ulster, and the coach started off down the line of a motivational speech around, you know, the relevance, the historical relevance, etc. And he realised that we had a player from there, and he took a swift detour and it was quite humorous, actually. But in terms of videos, I think the video should be more around your own highlights, whether it's, you know, a great tackle or outstanding work rate, etc. And I agree with Johnny, I don't think they should need it. Maybe just sign of the pressure he's under. You know, obviously he needs a goal, he needs a win, and he wanted to try and get him up for it. Maybe he felt the week wasn't, the players weren't, I don't know, motivated or whatever. But I think the most worrying thing for me is not, it's less around the video, it's around, you know, how it's got out, how the FAI have kind of added to the fuel, and how it kind of looks like he's being set up to fail a little bit now. And it's just, you know, with players coming out and there's lack of trust in the dressing room. James McLean came out saying, blaming the press, and maybe that was part of, you know, of the plan, but to try and create a them and us. But I don't see how it's good for a team who probably just need their confidence and a tightness to be created around them. So it's pretty worrying. I think you just love a goal off the backside to settle everyone down, because the longer he goes without that, despite the fact that they obviously are trying to change how they play, we'll just build the pressure on them. But it's just another crisis, or I suppose, for the FAI after obviously what's been a horrendous couple of years.
Yeah, Shane McGrath, the Mail, the headline is "Improving Tactics More Important Than Stirring Up Ancient Passions." You know, he says many of Kenny's supporters bristle at any criticism at all, and they continue to wonder why the story that broke last Thursday caused any fuss in the first place. But Shane McGrath says the reasons are obvious and they are more pragmatic than political. One of Kenny's strengths is said to be his understanding of modern coaching practices, the methods to which young, ambitious players can relate. Inspiration has its part to play in that, but Ireland's revolutionary history does not, no matter who the opposition are. So that's jumped out at me a little bit, Johnny, I have to say. Like, the fact that some people in the room were upset and thought it crossed a line, like, I don't know. I mean, it's really hard to know. The rebel songs have been a staple in Irish buses for decades. You know, it is, this weekend, the centenary of Bloody Sunday, there is the Anglo-Irish stuff just generally in the ether. And I don't know, like, to what extent can you bring HR into a dressing room? Like, are you allowed to go out and tell people to smash up these efforts and stuff anymore? Like, you know, if that leaks out, how does that suddenly look? So, look, someone was upset or someone thought it crossed a line, so they have to deal with that, in fairness. But I don't know, what jumps out to me more is why, in a room full of people probably married to English people, with children born in England, with English mothers, English fathers, a lot of whom were not born at the time of the Easter agreement, let alone like lived or remember the Troubles. What, like, going down this route just seems really old school to me. I think if I was sat in the room, I wouldn't be offended, but I would just think it's a bit cringy.
Yeah, yeah, it's the new young professional players nowadays. You know, they have different thoughts, and as you say, you know, just trying to stir something up, I suppose, in them, or you know, trying to listen. I'd say he's trying anything at the moment. Now, again, I'm with you. You know, you nearly prefer him coming over and putting his arm around you and say, "We need you today. You are the man today." You know, that kind of stuff, I suppose. But yes, someone took offence to it, and more than one, by the sounds of it. Probably not appropriate in the world we live in today. But probably wasn't meant in that way. He was trying to get a reaction, and I'd say if he's sitting back looking at it now, he says, "I could have done without even putting that video out." But it's done now. It has to be dealt with.
Yeah.
I hope it doesn't drag on. You know, I hope it's just done and dusted, and, you know, as you said, adding fuel to the flames, of which is probably just a bad judgment on his part. But again, they're in need of. I'm glad they're going to get a break now, and hopefully they can come back refreshed, wanting to play for Ireland. And you know, it's a tough game, because we're probably still living in the you know, back in the 90s there, when we had all those great players playing for Ireland. Like, you know, nowadays, I'm not saying the players are not great, but we just don't have those superstars. And in any team, whether it be rugby, soccer, GAA, you need that superstar that's going to put the ball in the net. We just don't have one at the moment, and hopefully one of those young lads will burst on the scene and give us what we need.
Bernard, two questions for you. So, and look, we haven't seen the video, we haven't heard the speech. Yeah. You know, like, it's just a messy situation. Like, I don't expect them to release the video to calm everyone down. So, I don't know what they're meant to do. I would agree with Johnny. I hope this thing blows over, because it just is ultimately, it doesn't feel that important, unless like someone is so upset they don't want to play for Ireland again. And everything we're hearing doesn't suggest the video was that bad. But the two questions to you, one. Did you use this stuff? Ireland play England quite a bit. There's the Croke Park game. Like, did you dig into history?
No, we didn't. It would have been, you understood it. You know what I mean? You didn't need to be a coach to tell you. You knew the magnitude of it, the historical background. You know, the player might say it in a meeting or something, but it would have been, I think the HR thing, you know, the dressing room should be sacred. It really should. You know, you shouldn't bring in the HR protocols into that. There has to be some element of, if you have a problem with it, say it. You know, challenge the manager for sure.
Is that the most damning? Is that the most damning thing? That what? Okay, so some people in the room had a problem with it. That nobody felt in a position to just go to Kenny himself and just say, "Look, yuck, it's not the end of the world, but I didn't think much of that. Can we just not go down that route again?" That's almost that level of trust wasn't in the room is kind of an issue.
Yeah. Going to your agent and or going to a journalist and you know, leaking it and saying the people are unhappy about it, I think that's not a great sign for where the group are at, and they can obviously repair this, and this can be the, you know, the starting point, but there needs to be some better more holy church to account, you know, rather than go off and leak and stuff. I just think it's sly, and it's a poor sign of where they're at as a team, and it's a new team and they're building, and maybe that trust isn't there yet. But if they're going to overachieve, which I would agree with, I think, you know, they're not the most talented team in the world compared to who they're playing against at certain times. They need to be really tight and be together.
Yeah. And as a coach, what would you have done then in this instance?
Well, look, if you made a mistake, you just hold your hand up and get the people in the room and say, "Look, I judged that wrong, badly. You know, I've taken on board, and it's not going to happen again." Okay. You know, you can't double down. You got to you know, you got to take the feedback and say, look, you know, that wasn't a good choice, and I own it.
Yeah. Interestingly, David Walsh in his piece says that there is a part of In the Name of the Father in this video. I mean, geez, if there's two videos I'd like to have seen, it's Roy Keane on MUTV that time and now this video. I don't think we're going to see either. So half-time, by the way, Tipperary in the Munster final are leading Cork by 11 points to 7, so 4-point lead for Tip. Johnny, why don't you take us wherever you want to take us next? Is there a piece that that caught your eye or you thought was an interesting talking point?
I think you'll have to cover plenty of it there. I suppose on the racing front,
yeah.
So I have to stick with the racing. Bristol De Mai, he won his third Betfair Chase yesterday. Brilliant horse. You know, Haydock is 10 lengths better at Haydock than he is anywhere else. So, you know, big win for him. And in Ireland, Notebook, he won the Grade 2 at Naas, his first run back. He's getting ready now for the Champion Chase, which is, you know, the big 2-mile race in Cheltenham. So, you know, it all starts now. You'll see all these horses coming out now and they'll be getting quotes for Cheltenham. So Notebook is one for the Notebook for the Champion Chase. But the big horse in Ireland this year that everybody is kind of looking forward to is the Gordon Elliott train, Envoy LN. He's, you know, unbeaten. He's done it on the bumpers. He's done it over hurdles, and now he started his chase career last, you know, a couple of weeks ago in Down Royal with a very impressive win. So on the racing front, they're the big talking points. It's you know, it's so compact now, the sport. You know, the sport on the weekends is so compact from the GAA, the hurling, the football, the rugby, and then you come along and Katie Taylor last week again, you know, she's you know, unbelievable what she's doing. And I think she's you know, her dedication, she's an iconic figure for any young girl or young boy starting out. That, you know, hard work pays off. You have to put in the hours, you have to, you know. And again, it's like the Meath footballers or the Irish team, how you react, you know, it's done, past tense, gone, can't do anything about it. How are we going to react? That's what you want to see the top sports people doing. And the piece on Tiger Woods, I suppose, in the paper today, how we reacted to having a 10 on the 12th hole in Augusta. You know, still the defending champion, he's got a 10 on a par 3, so it makes all those golfers kind of feel a little bit better. How he reacted to that, and how Shane Lowry's, you know, his reaction to him, well, she just said, she's Tiger Woods, he's the best in the world. So that's what you have to do as a sportsman. You know, brush it aside, past tense, don't carry it with you, the next one. And that's what coaches are always, the next ball or the next game. And in racing, it was probably quicker. You didn't have to wait that long for the next game. It was the next race. So that's the way I looked at it. Get beaten one, bad luck, head down, coming in upset. Okay. Mm. Next race, the next one. So that's what I like to see and how I like to see reaction to a bad result.
Yeah, that's Paul Kimmage. I think it sounds like he's spoken to Shane Lowry about playing with Woods on that Sunday. It's a short enough column on page 7 of the Sunday Independent. And it's, you know, Lowry was saying, it's funny because anytime Woods hit a bad drive or an average drive, he'd say to Joe LaCava, his caddy, that was one of yours, Joey. But Paul writes, the laughing stopped when Tiger arrived on 12. So then Lowry is saying, we stood on the 13th tee and Bo, that's Shane Lowry's caddy, Bo said to me, what do you think I'd say if I said to him, I bet you wish Joe LaCava had hit that one? and I, being Lowry, said, maybe don't say that. Then he says, Tiger didn't talk for a couple of holes, but you want to see him. Whew, it was incredible to watch. And the insane thing is, like, Woods birdies 5 of the last 6 holes. He birdies 15, 16, 17, 18. It's the greatest finish to a round that, you know, he's ever played in his 23 years at Augusta. It's just extraordinary when your head's fried that you could regather yourself like that. Larry said, I mean, he's Tiger Woods, isn't he? He's the best of all time. So that is most certainly, it's just nuts. That's on page 7 of the Sunday Independent. There's quite a few pieces, fellas, talking. Well, I guess you could broadly, Bernard, kind of put it into a what sports people sacrifice in terms of their bodies when it comes to sport. We have Graeme Souness writing about the end of heading in football, given the links with dementia now, and he's talking about how, like, pretty soon he doesn't think he'll be allowed to tackle on the ground. And he's in favour of this, by the way. He's not like old school, oh, look, heading's fine, get on with it kind of thing. He is actually saying this heading business needs to stop. The evidence is overwhelming. And we have in the Mail on Sunday, Mike Tyson fights Roy Jones Jr. Next Saturday, which is just insane to be saying in 2020. And then David Walsh has a big piece on concussion, dementia, again, the things that sports people put their bodies through as well. So they're all kind of looming around the papers today.
Yeah, and, you know, they're all linked, really, to be honest. I'm not really a fan of this whole, you know, legends of boxing coming back. Tyson and Roy Jones, combined age of 105, you know, and they're using the heavy gloves, which obviously should protect them a little bit. But it's just worrying for me that there's so many of these great boxers, you know, Oscar De La Hoya, Evander Holyfield, Floyd Mayweather, still talking about comebacks, and, you know, when is enough enough? And, you know, is there an appetite there? There must be, obviously. You know, they're talking about maybe making $8 million out of this fight, but it's not really something that I'm a fan of. But David Walsh, he looks at the effect of dementia in sport, and look at he used an example from rugby league last week, and I don't know if you saw it, but the State of Origin, you know, really competitive physical contests, and always is. But there was an incident, you know, when one of the star players, Tedesco, and Cordner got into a bit of a... There was an incident, a heavy tackle. It looked like Cordner was concussed. He clearly was. And yet, you know, he played a further 48 minutes afterwards. And, you know, one of the pundits, a great pundit, Andrew Johns, you know, he was scathing of those who criticised Cordner's return to action. And he said, I wish all those people who have no idea what's going on behind the scenes would shut their mouths. But last year, Johns admitted he's having epileptic seizures since 2016. And he said doctors couldn't be certain of the cause, but they had suggested that the concussion suffered during his career may be a factor. And perhaps the greatest of all rugby league players, Wally Lewis, has part of his left temporal lobe of his brain removed to combat his epilepsy. And there's a couple of different examples. And I know, look, rugby's not perfect, rugby union. We've come a long way. But, you know, this whole macho image around concussion. And in rugby league, you know, I've studied rugby league. I've gone to spend some time in rugby league environments. The level of concussions in rugby league compared to rugby union, or how many are diagnosed or declared, is far less. And also, they still allow you to have headshots. So it's just something that probably we need to keep an eye on. And he just at the bottom, he says, what I'm reading, and I haven't read this yet, but certainly it's on my list, Knife in the Fast Lane, A Surgeon's Perspective from the Sharp End of Sports by Bill Ribbons. And he just said, this should be required reading for all of those responsibilities for the welfare of athletes. So look at, you know, it's the amount of information we have at our hands nowadays. There really should be no excuse for some of the mistakes being made again that's happened in the past. And, you know, I just think from a veterans coming back boxing, maybe having one fight too many, you know, other sports not taking concussion seriously, along with the whole, you know, the issue around is heading safe for soccer, and how that will unfold, for me, are definitely worth talking about.
In fairness to union, and maybe it is by necessity, but like it's so much further down the line in attitude to head injuries than so many sports. Like, I was watching the game at Old Trafford last night, and West Brom defender got a ball volleyed from Harry Maguire flush in the face, like a rifled volley flush in the face, fell on the ground. I mean, I couldn't say he was unconscious. I don't think he was, I suspect. But like, it doesn't even occur to the commentary team that this might be bad. You know, in the week when dementia and football has been talked about at length, they're talking about how, geez, he's a tough cookie. You know, yeah. A tough cookie, got back up, and he's going to head the ball for the rest of the game. Like, it doesn't seem to occur to the referee, to anyone. Go get checked out. You know, there's no HIA. Like, football is a million miles behind in that respect. Johnny, Punch Drunk is the headline on this Mike Tyson, Roy Jones piece. You know, you have Tyson, 54 now, Jones is 51. I mean, you'd sort of worry for Tyson. He hasn't boxed for 15 years. Like, Roy Jones Jr. was still fighting up until 2018 and was unbelievably fit. Will you go out of your way to find Tyson versus Roy Jones? Would it kind of intrigue you, or would you think, oh Jesus, we shouldn't be doing this at that age?
So, listen, when you get over 50, like I am now, you kind of still think you're 21. You know what I mean? You've been out for a while. You're looking at all these other young lads come along. You think you can do that. So, you know, I still think I could be able to ride in a race, you know, and do all the things I used to be able to do. So these guys are probably thinking they're, you know, and I suppose Bernard would still like to be in Lansdowne there throwing the ball around, or the Aviva there throwing the ball around to his mates, you know. But, you know, you're a bit slower. Might be able to duck out of the punches. So it's something, yeah. You know, you don't, you wouldn't like to see anybody getting injured or but they're probably sitting at home, nothing to do. They want to get active, they want to get back up on the thing, and it's an exhibition bout. Now, to have an exhibition boxing match, I don't know how exhibition is going to be by them two.
Well, apparently they've been encouraged not to knock each other out.
Yeah.
You couldn't make that up.
But it's like Graham Souness says, no, you can't hit in the head. You can only hit around, you know, the chest or the other person's gloves. Maybe that's what they're going to do. But no, I think, I can only speak in racing. You know, I know Adrian McGoldrey, Rick, or the doctor that used to be the head doctor in the racing, he's very adamant on concussion. You know, a jockey now gets, we do a baseline at the start of the year.
Yeah.
And when you get a fall, if you get a bang at all, you have to go and do it. And if it's not up to scratch, you know, it's every 6 days you go back and do it again. So it was something, it was never heard told of in Irish racing. I remember jockeys coming in after getting falls and the doctor would lead them in and say, yeah, doc, I'm fine, not bothering me. And then they'd look around and say, where am I sitting? You know, but yeah. Hey, that's the way it was. And as I said, the hard man game where you have to be seen to be a hard man. But I think the science has moved on now. And
did you take much punishment, Johnny? Like, I'd have the perception a flat jockey wouldn't take near as much as National Hunt.
I never broke a bone in my life. Like, when lads go to me, oh, you were a jockey, you must have broke a lot of bones. I never broke a bone in my life. The only bone I broke was my collarbone skiing. So I was very lucky, but I did take a few falls, and I never didn't even know what concussion was, but I took a fall in Wexford one night, and I remember going home, and, you know, we stopped in the shop, we had a few, you know, drink and a bit of salmon or whatever on the way home, and the next morning I got up and I was kind of very dizzy, and I had to sit on the side of the bed and close my eyes, and I remember saying to myself, you're all right, Johnny, don't panic, relax. And then speaking to the doctor later about it, he says, gee, Johnny, you got concussion, you know, and it was only a delayed reaction. Listen, I got up and I probably rode 2 days later, but you know, so who knows? But as a sportsman, you do make sacrifices, you do get the falls, you get the bangs in the head. You know, at the time you do not think, oh, this is bad for my health. You probably can't think like that, or you wouldn't be at your sport. But all the science now is adding up, and if it does come out that, you know, heading the ball can lead to, or falls can lead to this or can lead to that later down in life, well, you just have to put more precaution in place for these young people coming along, that they, you know, that it might not happen to them. But, you know, there's so much there nowadays, you know, so much science, you know, we have to be looking after the younger people. But as I said, in racing, from where it was and where it is today, you know, we are, you know, way ahead, and the doctors are really on the pulse now. If a young guy gets a fall, they're gone to get the baseline concussion again.
So what's the biggest issue then in flat racing? Is it weight, you know?
The weight, like for me, now the weights have gone up in recent years, but the young lads coming in are getting bigger now. Mm. You know, they're taller, everyone's long and skinny now, you know, that kind of way. So they're all light, so it is an issue. You know, the lads have to watch their weight.
And why, Johnny, can't they just increase the allowed weight to something approaching kind of normal? Like, I always remember Kieran Fallon's book, and he would talk about, you know, out for dinner at the restaurant, and if there was a restaurant with loads of jockeys in it, you know, an hour after dinner, you'd see them all in the car park throwing up almost, kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so the pressure is just incredible to keep your weight.
Well, yeah, if you can't make the weight, you can't ride. So if you can't ride, you can't get paid. And that's it. You know what I mean? So, but again, I think that was a number of years ago. I think we've moved on from that as well. There's a jockey pathway now down in Reyes. So, you know, at a young age, you are getting the pathway to go. You know, I done it the right way and I done it the wrong way. When I done it the right way, you can see the success I had. When I done it the wrong way, you had the success, but you were never where you wanted to be. You were never as professional as you should have been. So I think the young lads nowadays, it starts at the top. Colin Keane is the champion jockey in Ireland. You know, he's very quietly spoken, lives a good life, you know, very professional. You know, before him was Pat Smullen. So Pat Smullen would have set a very, very high standard. All them young lads looking up to him now. And that's the way it is now. The weights are higher now, so lads are not as hard. But right. if you keep pushing up the weights, the heavier lads will keep trying to lose. So
I see. You're always bringing someone into it, yeah. Yeah.
Somebody yeah. struggling with their weight.
That's a fair
but
point.
I think nowadays, now, it's a bit like the concussion. We're so far ahead. You know, you'll get checked out by the doctor. You have to be rehydrated. You have a set weight. You know, you cannot go below your lowest minimum weight nowadays. So there's more safety guards in place, but there is always somebody struggling with their weight or doing that 2 pound lighter than they're naturally able to do. But hey, it's a sacrifice. It's part of the game. And if you want to be in it, that's the sacrifice you have to put up. But I must say, that's the best part of being retired as a jockey. When some people say, what's the best part of being retired as a jockey? And you say to them, I can eat now. Like, they're just blown away.
Bernard, I rugby players seem to go the other way. They lose weight when they retire.
Well, bar me, yeah. There, most of them do. I'm the outlier. It's interesting. And Johnny, were they allowed an extra couple of pounds because of COVID, because the saunas weren't open? Is that still the case?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah, they're allowed an extra couple of pounds. And I think that's going to stay in place again. You know, when I was riding, horses in maiden races were carrying 9 stone and 8-11. Yeah. Now, you know, because a filly will always have 3 pound less than a colt. Nowadays, they have 9-7 and 9-2, because a filly is getting a 5 pound allowance now. So it's 9-7 and 9-2. And most of the lads are comfortable with that, and they're getting an extra £3 because the saunas are closed, and that's because of COVID. But I do think that will stay in, because I think it's been a help for jockeys, and they'll be definitely, you know, fighting to keep that in place.
And Johnny, you said you've done it the right way and you've done it the wrong way. I mean, I think we all know what the wrong way is. What was the right way, and how manageable was that when it came to your weight?
Yeah, well, it's just having a team around you. You know, I had my dietitian. I checked in with my dietitian once a week, Gillian O'Loughlin. You know, she was going, like, I'd tell her what I was eating. I want to eat 1,500 calories a week. I'd go to the gym in the morning. I'd run in the evening. No fizzy drinks, no dairy products, fish, vegetables, chicken, vegetables, steak once every 2 weeks. You know, I had my own masseuse. He used to come in 3 times a week. I had my driver. I had a team around me. Rather than doing it all on my own,
yeah.
I had a team around me. I had a guy I spoke to all the time. If there was anything going on in my life or anything that was bugging me in any way, I spoke to him. So my mind was clear. I just had to rock up at the races in good shape. Like the last 15 years of my career, I was right at the top because, yeah. You know, I had those things in place, and it's not by accident.
Yeah.
You know, it's not by accident. And
you said there 1,500 calories per week. I presume you mean day.
No, per day. Sorry, per day.
Right, okay.
She used to say to me, Johnny, you know, I'm a dietitian, and that is like, that's borderline on the science I have to do. And I says, now when you're working with jockeys, I says, you have to try and just make it easier for them. Give them the portion sizes that they can eat. That's what they can eat.
Yeah.
And she used to come down, and she used to cook meals for the, you know, down in Ray. She used to show us how to cook meals, and, you know, but they were the people that they're available to all the younger jockeys now. And I always felt myself as an athlete, not just, oh, I'm just a jockey and I've just arrived. I wanted to be an athlete, top athlete. And if I'm the fittest jockey in the weigh room, maybe I'm one up already on them. You know, I'm the fittest here. So I try to be the fittest jockey every year. So now I'm ahead of them. I'm ahead of the rest of them. And I just need everything else to fall into place then as the year went on. So, it's only when you do it the wrong way and it's so bloody hard that when you're eating the chips and you're eating the Chinese, or when you go out and how hard it is to maintain the weight than, you know, if you're eating the good stuff, how easy it is. Yeah. You know, you'd be wondering, so why would I do that to myself? But, you know, that's those little treats every now and again used to, you know, they'd probably keep you going for another month.
And Bernard, did you get into a good regimen? Were you somebody who had everything down and it was the same day in, day out, or were you a bit all over the place?
Pre-season when there was fat club around. So if your body fat was over a certain level, you got punished with extra 6 o'clock sessions. That would get me back in track. And then obviously in season, yeah, you've got games to focus on and just give you a routine. But we used to let ourselves go for 4 or 5 weeks completely. I think now that doesn't happen. It's usually 10 days, and then fellas, even in their off season, they're keeping on top of their conditioning. But I agree with Johnny, it's around having some stability and, you know, having a really good habits, really. That's the key.
Do you know, as you're talking there, and it ties in with the Stephen Kenny video thing, so something like Fat Club, which you would not have given a thought to in your life, you know, I'm in Fat Club, yeah. I'm not in Fat Club. Like, at what point now are dressing rooms, given that they're employers, going to have to come into line with HR practices that, you know, there's not a Fat Club in News Talk, do you know what I mean? Because you can imagine what would happen, you know. So that, are we heading that way where dressing rooms are just going to have to be run that way, and there's going to have to be a line in the sand, and there'll be a bunch of people saying, you can't run a dressing room like that. But what if someone's in Fat Club at 19 and they feel really bad about it?
I do think we can't call it that anymore, and rightly so. It's just, well, like, we didn't see it as being
a sign of the way the times are changing.
I'm sure, Johnny, you obviously employ a lot of people, you know, you probably can't speak to them as you were spoke to maybe as an apprentice, etc. It's just the way it is. And I suppose hopefully it's going to lead to a better environment, a safer environment for everybody.
Yeah. Well, we're pretty much out of time. Just to mention, by the way, I'm sure a lot of people have been looking at the centenary of Bloody Sunday over the last couple of days. Mick Foley, who's, you know, wrote The Bloodied Field, brilliant book, and has been a part of this week in various ways, has written about the Tipperary team on page 14 and 15 of the Sunday Times, if you're interested. And it's very interesting. All the detail in it is extraordinary. You know, he has little moments like when the Black and Tans were on the pitch, the Tipperary goalkeeper, Frank Scout Butler, could tell the story of the policeman kicking him as he lay on the ground. The policeman saying, "You're one of those gunmen who killed our lads," the policeman said. And then the goalkeeper, Tipperary goalkeeper, responds, "Last time I fired a gun was on the Somme," and he rolled up his sleeve to show a British regimental tattoo, you know. Or Mick has a thing, he's a great picture of the team, and he goes through where they all ended up. And it's shocking, you know, like he says, in the end, Bloody Sunday didn't rip the heart from the team, life did. By the mid-1920s, half the Bloody Sunday team were dead or emigrated. Like, a lot of them found life very tough afterwards. Like, Jimmy McNamara suffered, he was the centre forward that day, suffered acutely from the trauma of Bloody Sunday. He died in 1929, aged 36. Stories like that, quite a lot of them emigrated, many of them died young. So if you're interested, page 14, 15 is really worth a look. Fellas, I think we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for that. Bernard Jackman, thank you. And Johnny Murta, thanks a million. Much appreciated.
Thank you very much.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Cheers, fellas. The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.